an informal session. Richard said he likes to be interrupted during his talk, so. But please help yourself to cookies and coffee, drinks, and I think we'll get started now since it's a little bit after four. Very happy to welcome Richard Pomfret to the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies. And I'm Robert Ortheim, the Assistant Director. So today, we'll be talking about diversification of an energy-producing economy, agricultural policy, and Kazakhstan. So I think probably a few more people will come in, but as I said, we'll have a very informal session, and so please feel free to interrupt the speaker and ask him questions or disagree with him. I think seems like
best.
A friendly guy.
Disagreeing is the best.
He'll be happy to engage
don't
in
like
conversation. So we'll have about 30 to 40 minutes of talk, and then the floor will be open for questions. So, but the floor is always open, so please.
Thanks, Robert. And thanks for inviting me. I'm very impressed at how the Central Asia program here has grown so quickly in about a year with Marlene and yourself and Sebastian. And very impressive set of papers you put out. So I hope mine is adding to that rather than detracting from the quality. So I'm not sure exactly what everybody's background is here. So what I'm interested in talking about is Kazakhstan's agriculture. Why? Because I think it's an important part of the economy, but also the way that policy is involved in agriculture has been reflective of the nature of the state, too. But before doing that, I think I'll just give about 10 minutes to give some background about Kazakhstan's development in general, and then put the agricultural sector in that context, and then talk about how the policies towards agriculture have changed over the two decades since independence. And I guess there's a disclaimer at the bottom of this that a lot of my work on agriculture the last 2 years was part of an OECD review of agriculture in Kazakhstan, and I'm also currently working at the World Bank on this, and my views are not those organizations' views. Okay, so what is the heritage? And part of why I want to put this as a background is that Kazakhstan, the area that Kazakhs lived in, is now Kazakhstan, has gone through a lot of major changes. It's not a static place. So when the Kazakhs first are identified as a group, the nomads, pastoral, livestock rearing, they ask for some protection from the Russians against other nomad groups and are gradually absorbed into the Russian Empire. And at that time, we get some settlement by farmers from elsewhere in the empire, Russians, Ukrainians, and so on. And also we get development of cotton after the incorporation of Central Asia into the Russian Empire in the 1860s. You're not, it's not a coincidence, it's when there's the American Civil War. And so cotton is not a big thing in Kazakhstan, but it is concentrated in South Kazakhstan. It was the third biggest export from Kazakhstan at the time of independence after coal and mineral, coal and fertilizers. 1917, we have a revolution, some big changes in the revolution. Two big changes. One is the collectivization of agriculture, and Kazakhstan was the part of the Soviet Union that was fiercest in resisting collectivization. Many Kazakhs killed their animals rather than allow them to be taken over into the collective farms. Estimates of how many people died from starvation, resistance, killing go up to about 3 million people, which is a huge number for a sparsely populated place. And the Kazakhs lose. I mean, the farms are collectivized. There's also, I think, a positive thing. I mean, the Kazakhstan's economy grew pretty rapidly in the Soviet era. And one of the reasons for that was the development, especially of mining in the region. So the economy becomes one that's not solely dependent on agriculture. The mining is it's in isolated towns scattered across the interior of the country. Coal, iron ore, lead, zinc, and so on. It's not energy. It's not oil. The second big thing that happens to the country is the Virgin Lands Program under Khrushchev. It starts in the mid-1950s, runs into the early 1960s. Large area of land in northern Kazakhstan that's very similar to Ukraine, geographically, climatically, Siberia, geographically, climatically. It's brought into grain farming. It's about 60% of the current arable area is this area that's brought into production. Again, there's a major inflow of people from the Western Soviet Union. So it's primarily Russians who are coming to farm the virgin lands. We also had in the 1930s some movement of people sent to Kazakhstan against their will, Solzhenitsyn being the most famous, in internal exile. After war breaks out in 1941, Stalin also moved groups he thought were unreliable, Germans from the west and Koreans from the east, to Kazakhstan. One of the consequences of all that is that Kazakhstan was the only republic that didn't have a majority for the titular nationality at independence. About 40% Kazakhs, 40% Russian, 20% other groups, Germans, Uzbeks, Koreans. And this is, I think, fairly important for understanding the immediate post-independence history. The final thing I'll mention before independence is that in 1990, Mikhail Gorbachev, interested in developing the oil industry, was having trouble developing the resources that were known to exist in the Caspian area, signed the biggest joint venture deal in Soviet history with Chevron to develop the Tengiz field in 1990. A year and a half later, the Soviet Union no longer exists, and by chance, Tengiz is not all that many kilometers inside Kazakhstan. Boris Yeltsin tried initially to claim that it was really should be part of Russia, but it's tremendously important for the future of Kazakhstan. So if we look at the geography of the country, I mean, it's a funny geography. This is the cotton area down to south. This is the area, the rain-fed agriculture, where farmers have settled it starting in the 19th century. The northern grain belt, the virgin lands area, is around here. And the oil area is here. Tengiz is here. And the major offshore oil fields are in here. Yes, and then we've got this big hole in the middle that's only really characterized by your mining towns like Karaganda, the biggest coal mining area, and things that benefited from isolation like the cosmodrome where Yuri Gagarin went to space. Some agriculture also in the east, which is also where the nuclear testing was. So you're very sparsely populated, but with your clear regional differences in the country. While I've got the map up, I mentioned one other thing. The capital of independence was Almaty. One of the earliest things that the president did was move the capital in 1997 to Astana. Clearly we can see this is not an economic decision, it's a political decision. Serious concerns about the possibility of secession or irredentism with the Russian populated north. So people talk about it moving to the centre of the country, and it's a funny view of centre. I mean, it's clearly moving there to be more closely connected. It was Astana, essentially a Russian town, Selenograd before, to connect with the Russian minority. When we look at what happens after independence in December 1991, Kazakhstan clearly has your three major shocks that are apply to all of the post-Soviet countries. It's going through the transition from central planning. It's also there's a dissolution of the Soviet Union, which led to breakdown a lot of demand and supply chains. And this was important. So a lot of the mining towns I mentioned had difficulty because they couldn't get machinery, spare parts. They lost some of their markets. Major social problems. If one industry town closed down, about 30 of those towns in Kazakhstan. Also important for agriculture to see that inputs, imported machinery, fertilizers were going to cost more, and the markets for Kazakhstan's goods were breaking down. And also transport was something you had to pay for now. And the third big shock was the hyperinflation that was fueled by having a common currency that nobody really controlled the emission of. And the ruble zone collapsed, but it took some time before the government got control over. Please come in.
Sorry.
Now, as I mentioned, these three shocks applied to all of the former Soviet republics. I think it was complicated in Kazakhstan. you want to say something about coffee or anything? Or
Well, you're all welcome to have coffee and cookies if you like, and there's coffee to the people.
In Kazakhstan, it was a bit complicated because of the nation building that I mentioned. I mean, this was a top priority. I mean, there were many predictions in 1992 that Kazakhstan would not survive as a unified state. Part of that story was the moving of the capital. There was also massive emigration. You know, particularly the people of German heritage could return to Germany and get citizenship. The first international flight from Kazakhstan was to Hanover. And many Slavs left. And it was biased. I mean, these were the people, the more mobile people, the ones that were better trained. So this was a major problem. Also, there was a big distraction in the 1990s as the government was negotiating product sharing agreements for oil and gas development. At the time, you know, this was a source of huge reports, if anyone remembers this time, of corruption. There was a vice president of Mobil served 48 months in jail for not reporting his bribe for tax purposes. And you know, all kinds of stuff about institutional degradation. But also it was important because the agreements were signed. So it was good for the future in that oil production was going to be flowing when the oil prices start to go up. On the positive side, there were reforms to the economy. The market economy was established. There was macroeconomic stabilization. The inflation rate was brought down to below 50% by 1997. And the president had this vision for the longer term. Any of you who are familiar with Kazakhstan will keep hearing about the 2030 strategy to make Kazakhstan one of the 50 richest countries in the world by 2030. If we look at what happened in the 1990s, and this isn't the best diagram, Kazakhstan's, this is it, so we see it's right in the middle here. It's typical of the former Soviet country, that the transitional recession is very deep, much deeper than Eastern Europe. The Central Europe's brown line. Just as Kazakhstan's starting to recover here, they get hit in 1998 by the Russian crisis, and so there's a double dip recession, and then it starts to pull out. So, you know, fairly typical picture among the former Soviet republics. And this, I think, is a clearer picture of what happened to GDP. There's negative real GDP growth, 15%. It's kind of difficult to know how you measure these things because the composition of GDP has changed so much. But clearly, it was your major recession up until 95, 96, and then this is the double dip with the Russian crisis. But then after 1999, you know, clearly there's a turnaround, and 10% growth up until like 2007, 2008. So you're very clear picture of two different decades. You know, 1990s are really a harsh decade. After 1999, there's a boom, partly because of good policies. You know, the government was running the macroeconomic policies. They had a devaluation of the currency, got the reasonable value of currency after 1999. But overwhelmingly, it's driven by oil exports. The boom is driven by oil exports. Because what happens at the same time, you've got a big increase in oil output. At the same time, as oil prices are going from, you know, under $20 to up to over $140 by 2007. And we've also got lower transport costs. You know, so Tengiz comes online, it's a big field. The Kashagan oil field in the Caspian is discovered. It's not, still not come online, but there's huge investment going on from the beginning of the 2000s. So that's adding to the boom. World oil prices soar, and not independently, and new pipelines are built so that they're no longer dependent on the Transneft pipeline and the monopoly power that gives. There's a private pipeline built to the Black Sea for Russia, the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline from Azerbaijan, which could be hooked onto by boats across the Caspian, and then a pipeline to China. So the transport costs of getting the oil and later gas out have gone down. It's a perfect storm. That's right behind those, very high growth rates, among the highest in the world of the last decade. But there's also a lot of talk about there being a resource curse, that some countries that have had oil booms have not done very well. And so among the things that the government in Kazakhstan has done was They established a national fund in the early 2000s. At the time, it was for any revenues when the price was over $19 a barrel, which sounds kind of quaint today. But yeah, they have put, it's about $40 billion in it now. They have put substantial amount of money that's gone into the national fund for future generations and also for emergencies. So, for example, the oil boom led to a real estate boom in Almaty and Astana. The bank, some of the banks went bust after the bubble burst in 2007, and the national fund was used for a stimulus package. So we don't see on those GDP figures, you know, we saw a small dip here in 2008, 2009, but it never gets down to negative growth. This stimulus package kicks in. Also, what the government has done with this windfall of the oil revenues is it's spent it on infrastructure, on education, and on diversification. And for most economists, that would seem a pretty good set of things to spend it on. Although, obviously, there is debate and argument about the specifics. And you know, the story that I want to tell in the talk today is really about agriculture, because agriculture and agribusiness have been a prominent part of this diversification. You know, it's been one of the areas the government has poured the most money into to try to diversify the economy beyond being solely dependent on oil and gas. Okay, so has anyone got any questions about that? Because the rest, that's my 10-minute introduction. The rest is about agriculture. So I say, I'm not sure how familiar you all are with Kazakhstan, or whether you agree with my summary. Okay, so, I mean, agriculture in some sense is a microcosm of this. So if we look at agriculture in the 1990s, yeah, it's, as I mentioned, the breakdown of supply chains was important for the whole economy. It was really important for agriculture because it relied on imported inputs. You know, the machinery and equipment came from Belarus, came from Russia. Those prices went up. Other inputs, fertilizer prices went up. And at the same time, there were farmers who were exporting were charged market rates for transport and so on. That made it made their wheat less competitive. So there's a big gap between the increase in input prices, which is much greater than the increase in output prices when you have the hyperinflation. You know, they both go up because inflation's whatever 1500% a year. At the same time, you have a decline in subsidies that in the last decade of the Soviet Union had been fairly substantial net subsidization of agriculture, particularly livestock. Had been under Gorbachev had been a program to try to increase meat consumption, for example. But you know, all the estimates we have of support for farming show positive support for livestock, for grain, for cotton. This support, you know, we know from more detailed estimates for Russia or Ukraine, but what we know for Kazakhstan, this support had declined to more or less zero by about 1994-95. You know, subsidies that were paid were trivial, they were very close to zero. With the main policies in the 1990s are trying to reform land holding, but again, it's not very clear what's going on because the government has difficulty deciding, does the land belong to the state or are you going to go fully private? So the initial steps towards land reform are issuing long-term leases. The first law on land says the land belongs to the state, there's 99-year leases for private use. There's confusion over whether there can be subleasing of the land. There's confusion about, you know, how tradable the leases are, essentially. And associated with that is that the farms are not so valuable in the 90s because they're all getting deeper and deeper into debt. And they keep producing and they're selling and receiving less for their output than they're paying for their inputs. So there's pervasive farm indebtedness. You know, 3/4 or more farms are effectively indebted. And so we've got a fairly passive policy here. You know, the government is, you know, it's got its own concerns here. It's nation building, getting the oil industry going, not paying any attention to agriculture. There's a very large drop in output. especially in the livestock sector. I'll show you some numbers in a minute. But also agriculture played an important safety net role, that people lost their jobs in the mining industries or in the cities, they would also go back to their villages or to the dahas and return to farming as a way of eking out a living. So this is a table that's in the paper. What we see is these are 5-year averages. Then the production of grain falls by almost a half between the 1990 and 2000. Net exports stay roughly the same. Production of meat falls by just over a half, and that becomes essentially a non-traded item. And these are interconnected, because what's declining in the grain production is fodder. So the high-quality grain that's being exported and being eaten by humans, that holds up reasonably well. The grain that's being produced for animals, the production falls because the number of animals is falling. It's a little bit hard. What's a bit awkward about this is there's also a lot of fluctuation in annual harvest. So particularly for grain, if we look at grain production, you see that there is a trend down, I think, fairly clearly in the 1990s. But there are very substantial year-on-year variations. And that's to do with the Virgin Lands Programme pushing production into marginal areas. The World Bank estimated in 1992 that about 30% of the land shouldn't have been settled. It's a bit like the High Plains in the United States or the Northern Prairies in Canada. It was not clear where the frontier of settlement should have been, given the low rainfall and the soil quality. And we see this peak in 2011 is also misleading, because 2012 the harvest is about half as big. So don't get too fooled. We see it with the livestock, but we see a clearer picture. I think this is the bottom blue line is the slaughter weight of meat. So it's dropping from about 1.5 billion tons in 1990 to about 750 million in 1998 now, and not really recovering very much. That's part of what's going to happen. The other thing, livestock products here, milk and eggs, they do recover. And almost all of that is, particularly for the milk, but a lot of it for the eggs too, is on household plots. So I think any of you are familiar with Soviet or post-Soviet economy know the importance of these. So these are, the milk is coming from holdings of 2 to 4 cows that help, where people produce their own milk and sell any surplus on the local market or to a local dairy. They held up pretty well. You see that it's recovering before the recovery of the economy as a whole. This is part of the falling back into a safety net of making use of these household plots. That the government is not completely happy about, because they see efficient dairy farming or efficient egg production should be on big high-tech dairy farms or big holdings of chickens. If we want to look at what's happened to inputs, I think these are really, really dramatic stories. This is the stock of agriculture machinery, and you see this number of tractors, grain seeders and grain harvesters. It just diminishes by 80% between 1990 and 2000. This is the story of the price of inputs going up. And actually what it's a story also of is that your Soviet agriculture was more capital intensive than it would have been with market prices, because we see that it doesn't really recover. It's more or less in an equilibrium after 1999 in terms of how many machines are being used on these farms. Fertilizers, this is a really, I took this graph from the OECD report. It's actually quite a misleading graph. Because if you look at 1990, the true pre-independence level of fertilizer use is 600,000 tons. So although this looks like there's a trough and it comes back up, even when it's come back up in 2007, it's less than a tenth of the fertilizers being used in 1990. So it's important to bear in mind how much of a drop, a huge drop between 1990 and 1995, 600,000 to 30,000. It just, supply cuts off almost immediately after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And finally, this thing is a really interesting graph, because what it's telling us is between 1990 and 2010 or 2011, the percentage of agriculture share of GDP falls pretty well every country. It's part of development, it's part of what happens. Agriculture becomes a smaller share of GDP. Very dramatic in Kazakhstan. It goes down from 35% to about 6%. More dramatic in Kazakhstan because oil went up so much, so it's less percent. What's different about Kazakhstan compared to, say, Ukraine or Russia is that if we look at the share of employment in agriculture, it actually increased, going from 20% to 30%. And so you've got the share of GDP is going down, as we might expect, particularly dramatic. Yeah. But unlike Russia, Ukraine, which are probably the most similar types of agriculture, or other countries like South Africa, Brazil, China, or the OECD average, the number of people employed in agriculture has not fallen, it's gone up. Which tells you, I think, a lot about why this has remained an important sector for the government, when you've got a third of the labour force in it. The only other countries with this characteristic are Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, in much smaller economies. But similar kind of thing, that people moved back into agriculture, and the boom in the oil sector is not creating a lot of jobs directly. So it's not really creating a lot of employment. Okay, just to talk very, very briefly about the land reform. I mentioned this earlier. This is sort of going on as a separate track from the agriculture policy that I'm talking about, which is how much the government supports agriculture. So land reform, the initial land reform, say, asserts that the land belongs to the state, but the use rights are privatised. Any articles you see about privatisation of land in Kazakhstan in the 1990s, or a lot written in the late 1990s, you make the point that the collectives have been broken up in principle, but the state farm managers or the collective farm managers retained control over what was happening. So they still decided what the crop mix was, etc. The situation didn't change very much. In 2001, there's an attempt to change the situation by reducing the leases to 49 years, but there's still uncertainty about subleasing, and still some uncertainty about the about tenure. You thought you had a 99-year lease, and the government just told you you've got a 49-year lease through a stroke of the pen. 2003, the government finally passes a land law that says that your land ownership is private. People can buy out their leases, turn it into private ownership, private rights. We should then have a land market develop. The land market developed very, very slowly because the people who had the 49-year leases were paying very small rents on those. So what actually happens is a lot of people don't particularly want to sell. They want to hold the land as an asset because it's almost costless just to keep holding it. So one of the issues today is how to try to make people who are not using the land put it on the market. But what we do see is there's some shift over the last 10 years towards an increasing number of individual farmers. Although there's a large variance by region and by crop. In the north, where you've got the grain farms, we still have some very large holdings, and some of them massive holdings. Individual farms are much more common in the southeast and the south. And small household plots remain important. So that's sort of background. Now, what my focus is in this paper is about how agricultural policy changed, by which I mean government spending on agriculture. How are they using the windfall, all this revenue from the oil sales, how are they going to use it? And the first indication they're going to use it for diversification, and by that meaning trying to change the agricultural sector, came in 2001 and 2002. The government, there's an initial program, but the big program was this agriculture and food program. Referred to as the $1 billion program, because that's how much money they were throwing into agriculture over 3 years. A lot of money. And the share of the central budget going to agriculture increases fairly substantially. The stated objectives of this were to ensure food security, establish an efficient system, agriculture and processing of agricultural goods, increase the sales of farm products, both domestically and exporting, and optimize state support for agriculture, whatever that means. That kind of seems obvious. So these are the stated goals, and what I want to talk about in the next 10 minutes is how well these are achieved, what you'd need to do to achieve those goals, and how well they're going to be achieved. So if anyone's got any questions, as Robert said at the beginning, please interrupt me, or if I'm talking too fast, tell me to slow down.
Alright. How many tenga make one dollar?
About 145. 145. Yeah.
Actually, I was wondering what explains the transition in the land reform policy, because it seemed to be going in the 90s, it seemed to be getting more conservative, you know, 99-year lease to a 49-year lease. Then all of a sudden you have private ownership.
Well, no, I don't think it's more conservative. I mean, I think the 49-year was to try, what they were worried about was there was no market. So you get, the idea was to have individual farmers, and the enterprising ones will buy up the neighbours and be good, and the people who didn't have farming skills would get out of farming, because that's, you know, the story of a market
right.
supposed to be. And so the 49-year was supposed to try to make it a bit more fluid.
Okay.
But it didn't. It made it a bit more chaotic, I think. I mean, it wasn't in place for very long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. There was this sense of the land is the Kazakh land, and it should be run by the, ultimately owned by the state. You don't alienate it.
Right.
And that's what took it, you know, 12 years to really resolve. But if you want to have a really market-based agriculture, there's got to be a market for land.
Right.
As I say, even today, the market, it's not very big, but it is growing. You know, that's the main complaint of a lot of the dynamic farmers that I've interviewed the last couple of years, is that they can't buy the neighbouring land, even though the neighbouring farmer is really incompetent, quote, competent, yeah, that they won't sell it.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, what's it involved in this agriculture and food program? Well, one of the things is that there's general services support. So this is what all economists would say, this is a good thing to improve the infrastructure and product quality. So you train more vets, right? You provide more grain elevators so that you can get the grain out so the animals are healthier. There's also input subsidies. Fertilizers were subsidized as long as they were produced in Kazakhstan. There were fuel subsidies to try to reverse this fall in the use of tractors. There were subsidies for seeds to try to ensure that farmers use higher quality or better varieties of seeds. And there were price support schemes that were aimed to stimulate output. So price support was provided through some parastatal organisations that were set up, that had been set up before but continued to exist but got a lot more money. And so they're purchasing, they're making guaranteed purchases of part of the harvest or of the meat. And this is where about 20% of the grain harvest is going in 2002. So, you know, what is the effect of this program? Well, we're giving these subsidies, guaranteeing good price for the output. What we see is the livestock sector situation improved fairly dramatically in terms of how much assistance is given to it. And we work out, you know, the nominal rate of assistance, which is the percentage that the net receipts of the farmer are higher than they would be with no government policy. So it said already there was some support. Already in the early 1990s, there was fairly strong support. It disappeared to nothing. In fact, it was negative in 2000. And by 2004, it was up to about 30%. And so fairly substantial shift in support that comes from guaranteed prices for the outputs and subsidies for inputs that went in. The wheat producers also had negative market price support, less pronounced than livestock, and the change is less pronounced. And this seems more to do with there being high trade costs. There was the cost of getting the grain from the farms onto the rail system through Russia or wherever you had to go to get to a port to get to ultimate markets. So we see a pattern of increased support, right, especially for livestock farmers, and a much more favourable policy to farmers. What was the effect of the programme? Well, we saw that there's some improvement in grain output, volatile due to climate, and not much pickup in meat production. So why was this these problems? Well, a lot of evaluations in 2006, 2007, the references are in the paper by the World Bank, by the Food and Agricultural Organization, USAID was there too, and the criticisms of the institutional structure of the program. So that, you know, the problems were that the implementation of the subsidy program, you say you're giving subsidies for grain and livestock producers, right, depending on how much they sell, right, but this was not clear. If you talk to farmers, they say, well, you know, that farmer who's connected to the local authorities got his subsidy really quickly. I didn't get mine until much later, and I had to take a loan to go through the season. There's also some obvious signs of corruption. You know, the fuel, the number of tractors doesn't go up, and yet the amount of fuel being used increases hugely. You know, what's happening? You know, people are getting the subsidies for the subsidized fuel and then selling it to the neighbours for the cars. So there were these problems. There was also, when we look at the fertilisers, the fertiliser subsidies were paid only to domestic suppliers. And yet the problem there was that the domestic supplies were of a lower quality than the imported fertilisers. So we see these institutional weaknesses that are in terms of, you know, how the subsidies are handed out, you know, some of the false incentives they create, or in ways that are actually distorting trade and are encouraging use of less efficient inputs. Then please stop me if anyone's got any questions. I'm an economist, I like this stuff, but I don't know if you are or not.